Okay, I'm going to go right away from the UN. We're done with the UN.
Okay, good.
Yes. I finished my BA at Hunter College. It took me a long time because I had to work, and then I wanted to go back. I wanted to go into the professional service at the United Nations. So I can't really leave the UN totally, but I wanted to go into professional service, and I needed to do my MA. And at first, I thought I can do it in the States in New York. I applied at CUNY. I went to the Graduate Center for one semester, but I didn't like it. It took too long, and it just was too hard. And everybody's saying, "Why don't you go back to Germany? You can study for free, and then you come back." So out of that, it took me about a year to make that decision. And I was still living with my boyfriend, and then he said, "I'll come with you," and I said, "Okay." And then it took us another year to actually move, or sort of prepare to move to Berlin. And so I first checked out what university should we go to and what city, and we figured, living in New York for so long, I think Berlin is probably the only place we would feel semi-comfortable in Germany, because we figured Berlin is closer to New York than anything else in Germany, or the closest that you could come, international, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so FU Berlin, I looked at what they offer. And I also wanted a degree that was not academic oriented, in the sense that didn't want to go into academia and become a professor at the university or something. And I wanted a, and so a friend of mine, she explained to me the difference between a diploma and a master's degree or a magister. And so there were only a number of universities that offered political science diploma, and Free University Otto Suhr Institute was one of them. And I said, "Well, perfect, Berlin and FU Berlin sounds great." And so I moved here. He came with me, and then we moved to Berlin, and I studied at the Otto Suhr Institute political science, and did basically international affairs, international relations was sort of the thing. It was Professor Albrecht at the time that then became sort of my advisor on that area. But then I also took a course that I saw in the thing that had to do with war crimes trials after the war in the GDR and in West Germany. And I thought, "Oh, that sounds interesting." And I said, "Why don't I do that? Why don't I take that course?" And I took that course, and that course was held by Wolfgang Schäffler. His wife, which I didn't know he was his wife at the time, Helge Grabitz, who was a Oberstaatsanwalt at the Staatsanwaltschaft in Hamburg, and oh my God, and I forgot his name now. I cannot believe I forgot his name now. How bad of me! He was a Staatsanwalt in the GDR of Nazi crime, of war crimes trials of Nazi criminals, and so they taught that course together. And it was a great course. I really enjoyed it. I loved all three of them, and especially Scheffler. And then basically that's how I got to Scheffler, who then was my thesis advisor, my diploma thesis advisor. And I adored his wife. She was this tiny little person, tough as a nail, and she did dedicated his life her life to prosecute Nazi criminals. She did it, she grew up. She was at, I mean, she had, I interviewed her for the archive then later too, and Scheffler as well. But I always thought she was great. Anyway, so I was, loved the course, did a paper in the course. I had to do some analysis, historical and political analysis of a trial, a Vlodava trial, which was which was near Sobibor, a town near Sobibor in the border in Poland. Anyway, so I did a paper. He basically threw the paper at me, and he said, "This is absolute crap." And I wanted to use this paper to also get him to say yes to me having asked him to be my advisor. So he said, "This is now," and he said, "I had my wife read it, and she said, 'Don't touch that person. Don't even think about working with the student. She doesn't know what she's talking about, and she writes German like it's half English. She has no clue.'" And I mean, he just ripped me apart. And I said, "Okay, can I try again? Can I rewrite the paper?" Because I knew I didn't do a good job. I knew I was doing it like very quickly, just used a week or so, and so I asked if I can redo it. We had a lot of debate about it, and then he finally gave in and he said, "Okay, but don't tell my wife." And I said, "Okay." And so I then took 2 months to rewrite the whole paper. When we moved to Berlin, you know, I needed to find a job to also just be able to live. My husband was American, so it wasn't easy for him to, A, he wasn't allowed to work at first anyway. And he had a 1 year, at the HDK, he went to the HDK for 1 year because he loved art and he loved to paint and stuff. And so he got a 1 year, I forgot, a student, a visitor student, student, what do you call it? He was a student for a year, but he was only allowed to be for a year. And so he was having a hell of a time because he was working before as a printer, always really working since he was 16, and now he could actually be a student, and he was already in his mid-late 20s. Mm. So he really enjoyed it, found a lot of friends here. Americans were still a lot around. I mean, there were different kinds of Americans at the time, many of them because of the American military bases that still existed very much. Mm. Not that he hung out with the military, just that... Anyway, so he found a lot of friends, and I was working at the law firm part-time that existed here, that really expanded at the time, especially because the wall came down and East European property became available. And so they actually dealt with a lot of Jewish survivors who now wanted to reclaim their property in East Germany, or former East Germany. And so this law firm did a lot of those applications and lawsuits and whatever for them. And so they hired me because of my English, because they had a lot of American clients because of that. So I did a lot of that correspondence, translating those documents and corresponding and stuff like that. And I was sort of that evening secretary. I always worked from 5 to 9 there. Pünder Verlag Lebanach, so they don't exist anymore today. They were merged with some other company, Clifford and Chase, and I think they don't exist anymore as a group anyway. I don't know. But anyway, and it was great. We were first in somewhere in Kudamm in office, and then they moved to Alexanderplatz in one of the buildings. They had the whole floor in one big building. So basically, I redid this paper, and I did a historical and a legal analysis. That's what it was, legal analysis. And since she's a prosecutor, she knows what she's talking about, and I had no clue, right? So anyway, so I redid that paper. It took me 2 months, used the law firm, used their library, to like really read up on what this whole law thing has to, what this all is, and Nazi criminals and post-war Germany law, and how you try, mass murders with the law that existed. It was really meant for, you know, your normal murder that kills one person, whatever. Anyway, so I redid it, handed it in. 3 weeks later, he calls me and he says, Frau Jungblut, we have a problem. And I said, uh-oh. And I was already, oh, no. I spent so much time and effort on this freaking paper. Come on. Give me something. And he said, well, my wife read it. She read both parts. And she believes that you did not write it. She is convinced that you hired a historian to write the historical part. And that you had a legal student or somebody with legal expertise write the legal analysis. And so when I heard that, and I said, yippee, I was like, yeah, I was so happy when he told me that. Because I knew I wrote it, so I didn't even hear the thing that she did not believe me, that she thought I faked it, that I, you know, had somebody else write this and all that kind of crap. I did not hear any of that. I just heard they liked it. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy about it. And he said, what are you happy about? And I said, oh, that means it's good. And he said, oh, it's excellent, but you did not write this. And I said, no, of course I wrote it. And he said, well, I think what we're going to do, you're going to come to my office one day, and I'm going to look into your eyes very deeply, and you're going to tell me the truth. And I said, okay, when do you want to do it? You want to do it tomorrow? We can do it tomorrow. Fine, because I just wanted to get going. And so I went to his office. I said, believe me, I wrote this. I worked so hard on this, I wrote. And he said, okay, I'm going to do something that my wife is not going to like. I'm going to say, okay, I'll take you on as a student. I believe you. But let's just keep this between you and me. Mm. And so, and then we discussed what topics we should do and that kind of stuff for my thesis. And then we decided on one. He didn't like my topics. And then I went with one that we both then agreed on, which was writing on the historical and political, because I was political science and he was actually historian, but he was also at the Zentrum für Antisemitismusforschung and the FU Berlin. He had a dual thing. And he said, being that you're doing it political science, we have to have a political component to your thesis. And so we did historical and political deportationsmechanism, deportation der deutschen Juden. And then what I said, but I would also like to do then, not only just a general, but I also want to do a little of my local history. So I want to use the experience of Darmstadt Jews in Darmstadt in the area, and make a local part in that paper. So he said, okay, the first three topics were, I think one was children in the Holocaust. And he said to me, no, that's too emotional. You're not going to be able to survive that. Which was kind of funny when I think about this now, because you know, anything you deal with the Holocaust is emotional. Because I actually just had a discussion about this with colleagues, and I kind of said, you know, if I'd said mass graves and mass murder in the East, Aktion Reinhard or death camps, you would just say, okay, good. And sort of like, yeah, like that's not emotional, right? Anyway, so we agreed on this topic. And then he held always these seminars. He had this group of PhD students and other students that we always met, and sometimes his wife came to this on Saturdays. And so I was always afraid when I attended them that his wife would show up one day and she's going to say, what happened? How come she's here? And then after about 6 or 7 months, there was actually one seminar meeting where she was announced that she will come to, and I was sweating so much. I was so afraid. And then I walk in and I had to go to the bathroom, and actually she was in the bathroom too, and so we were both next to each other. And I'm like, maybe she doesn't remember me. Maybe she doesn't remember me. She knew exactly who I was. And she just says, how are you? And I said, oh, I'm fine. And she said, good. It was very brief, very cold, no thing, but it was... I was accepted, and then like, okay, thank God, that's over. Anyway, so I wrote my thesis, handed it in, and you had to also do an oral exam for, you know, when you do the diploma. And that route, for that, I went international affairs, which I did with Albrecht. So Scheffler did not do my oral exam. Scheffler did the written thesis, and Albrecht did my oral. So I went sort of these both routes, because my intention was still to go back to the UN again. And writing my thesis is a whole story, because I had to, especially because I wanted to do the local history in Darmstadt, which meant it went into the Staatsarchiv in Darmstadt, which is the Hessische Staatsarchiv. And I went through their catalog, and there's files I wanted to see, and the archivist told me, you cannot see those files. And this all makes sense to me now of why I'm doing what I'm doing, in a sense, sometimes. So, and I just said, what? Why? And he said, well, they are sensitive. And I said, well, then why do you offer them in the catalog in the first place? And there's nothing about here insensitive. And then I happened to be sitting at a desk where somebody else across from me then said to me, once this archivist left, oh, you know, I saw these files 2 weeks ago or last year. And I said, and who are you, and what were you doing? And so he told me, well, I'm just doing research. I was doing it for I'm a local historian or something like that. And I said, okay, well, that's not right. This does not make sense. And so I got sort of frustrated, because they just, basically the archivist was telling me what I'm allowed to say. You know, you had to apply for access. So fine, you said why you were doing it. My professor wrote a little letter that he's supporting my work, and this is my topic, and this is what I'm doing, right? So, and the archivist wanted to select for me the kinds of files I should have access to and what I should see. And I did not like that at all. And I went into the Jewish community in Darmstadt. They opened up their archives, of course, no problem. I went to Wiesbaden. They opened up their archives a little more, but they wanted to, when I asked for copies, they blackened out a lot of stuff. Names of people, of course. Everybody's so afraid of names coming up. And I said, listen, I'm not a journalist. I'm not writing an article, that kind of stuff. I'm not going to, you know, put anybody in bad names. And these were people who were doing bad things, but they were afraid of it coming out again or something. It made no sense whatsoever. So I had really problems. And then I knew I wanted to see trial records in the Darmstadt Staatsanwaltschaft, in the prosecutor's office. because I know there's a couple of people that were tried, that were SS, and they came from Darmstadt, and they were doing mass executions in the East. It was known. Pifrada or something like that was one of them. And of course, the Staatsanwaltschaft said, are you kidding? Who are you? We can't let you in. This is impossible. So I got really upset. I talked to my professor, and he was saying, maybe we need to talk to Ignaz Bubis. I said, yes, let's talk to Ignaz Bubis. Let's make a big stink about this. You know, I want to get to these files. This is ridiculous and stuff. And so my professor said, no, I can't really do this and stuff. And so I talked to my father, and then my father said, listen, if you need help, I'll help you. And I don't want to ask my father for help. This whole thing, you know, I've been away for so many years, and now I'm living home for 2 months because I'm studying this local history, and it was complicated enough, and I just didn't want to ask my father for help, and I didn't want to have to push people to do something that they shouldn't be doing without having to be pushed. Anyway, so I couldn't do it without my father. He wrote a letter he said, write something down of the experience. He gave it to somebody that was somewhere politically connected. That person gave it to somebody else who had government connections, meaning Land, Hessen connections, government. Somehow it ended up in some sort of Staatssekretärsbesprechung, my case, so to speak, and it was discussed, and the outcome of it was a young German student should be supported in this kind of research, and it is outrageous that these things and obstacles are being put in front of this young, ambitious student, and this is not okay, and all that kind of stuff. And so the Staatssekretär calls my house, and it's this Frau, she was a woman actually at the time, from Frankfurt. She called me from her office. She was also some big shot lawyer, and she said, Frau Jungblut, I just want you to know, you have now access to the Staatsanwaltsfile, to the Landesarchiv file, and anything you want. And if you have any problems, please let me know. Wow. So all of a sudden, I did not get a red carpet at any of these places when I got back. But Zähneknirschen, did they open up their archives and let me look at, you know, the documentation I wanted to look at. And even at the Staatsanwaltschaft, they gave me an office, and I started to order, and then they shoved in the packets. Now, I have no idea if they left stuff out that they were able to do, because I wouldn't know that it even existed, kind of stuff. But there's a lot of material I got. A lot of material I got. I was able to go through. And the Hessische Staatsarchiv and Landesarchiv in Darmstadt, the head guy also called me before all of this, called me and said, Frau Jungblut, there's no reason why you need to see all these materials. I wrote about all these people, and they were also, some of it had to do with people, what would happen in November pogrom, who was involved, what did they do, those kinds of things I wanted to find out. And he said, you don't need to see those files anymore. These Germans that they may have been involved, had their punishment. They were tried after the war. You should let them rest in peace. Wow. And I said, I'm not writing an article. I'm not putting them out there. I'm not trying to rehash the history. And this whole thing was resting in peace. You know, the people that are really not resting in peace are those who were murdered. And, you know, and so it was actually, that was the really weird thing is the people, the German perpetrators that were alive, and their names available in these documentations, you were not allowed to use in any shape, form, or way. The Jewish victims that were killed, mm-hmm. no problem. Mm-hmm. You want to use them? Take them. Here, you have them. I'm not blacking it. I don't need to, because they were dead. Mm-hmm. So it was just total, ironic, disgusting policy. Mm. And it unnerved me totally every time. It's getting arguments and fights with them. How ridiculous that was. Anyway, so I got my stuff. I wrote my paper, went back to Berlin, and it all worked out. Did my oral exam, passed. It was good. I forgot what was my number. I think it was gut. It was nicht sehr gut, but gut. Good. And my paper was good, because I also discovered some mistake in some historian's book that referenced a document and said something happened at this day in Vienna, and this is the way it happened with the deportations there. And I tried to get the copy of that document that referenced it. And then nobody had it, and then they had a copy of it in the Leo Beck Institute in New York. And so I called them, and I asked the guy to actually look at it. And he told me what's in it, and I said, well, nothing, there's nothing in there that says what this historian is saying. And so I basically said, this person made a wrong conclusion from it. He's citing a document for something that is not in that document. Mm. And that occurrence and reference has been copied by other historians who wrote about stuff. Mm. Because he was this prominent, you know, it was a book that was written in the 60s or 70s, mm. and it's been copied that mistake in lots of other books that were written later by other historians who used that book as a reference. Mm. And so I kind of sort of made that a kind of a point. It was a footnote I made it. I didn't make it in the thing, but I made it as a footnote. Mm-hmm. And so I remember my Zweitgutachter really liked that. He said that was initiative. The student called and checked it out and went all the way, and they really liked that one. But he was upset that I didn't consult him more, because I really consulted only Scheffler with writing my thesis. But anyway, it's a different story. So I finished. I then actually worked for Scheffler for a little while as a research assistant, going through war crimes trials, witnesses, because he was hired by an organization in New York, and that was a lot of controversy later. There was a lot of problems later. I'm not going to go into that. Write the story of German Jews that were deported to Riga and their fate. And so I helped them going through war crimes trial, court trial stuff to create a list of survivors. Mm. And so I started to read a lot of trial witness stuff, which I've done some of it for my work too, because I went to the Zentrale Landesjustizverwaltungsstelle in Ludwigsburg to do some research as well. But that's where I really sort of, and I thought, this is interesting, because everything that I studied really before, a lot of it really was documentation that, you know, it's the typical thing that they say, perpetrator documentation that German history has always used in order to write the history about the Holocaust.
And that, just sort of keeping in mind the time.
Yes, 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 yes. I'm getting into it too much. Anyway, so I worked for him, and then at that time, that's now 95, at that time the Schorer Foundation started to come to Germany and was looking for interviewers in Berlin. And they were doing a training seminar in December 95 for interviewers. And I heard about it, and I thought, oh, this is interesting, I want to do this. So I applied to be part of the training seminar, to be invited. I got invited. I went there, and I thought this was very interesting. I only was there for one day because I was terribly sick. And then I heard that they're looking for people in Los Angeles for catalogers. And I thought, interesting. My husband knew somebody who was here in Berlin and did some work for his PhD thesis and went then back to Los Angeles and then worked for the Schorer Foundation. He was the historian there. And so they kept in contact, and he said, yeah, we're looking for catalogers. And then so he said what I did, and I said, well, that's interesting what she did, and because of the thesis she wrote and all that stuff, she might be a good candidate. So I applied. I flew to Los Angeles for one day to do the interview, and that was also third week of December. And I interviewed with a bunch of people there, and then I came back to Berlin. At the same time, I also was looking for a job at the UN, and there was an opening at an organization in Geneva, and I went there for an interview. Didn't get that, but Schorer Foundation offered me the position. And so they offered me the position, and before that, my husband and I got married so that there wouldn't be any sort of problems in any way, of shape, or form going back to the United States to get a job. And so, and then March 96, we moved to Los Angeles, and I started work at the Schorer Foundation. So I started as a cataloger at the Schorer Foundation in 96, March 96. At the time, they already had 10 to 15 people, I would say, in the cataloging department. You know, the organization was created in 94, came out of Schindler's List, meaning Steven Spielberg filmed Schindler's List, and survivors were coming up to him. And while he was filming in Krakow, and, you know, some of the locations where things really happened, and saying, it's great that you're saying, you know, that you're telling the story and that you're making this film, but, you know, it's unfortunate that nobody ever wanted to listen to our story or to my story. It was really individuals who came up to him, and he heard the same thing, you know, often. And I think hearing that from individuals that were all different people and that were coming up to him at different times sort of triggered this idea of, well, shouldn't there be an opportunity for them to tell their story? And so, really out of that, he gave life to this organization, or created this organization, Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation. He put two film producers in charge of the organization, because in that sense it was, being that Steven Spielberg is a film director, it was sort of, and it's kind of interviewing and filming somebody to interview is a production kind of thing in a sense. Mm-hmm. So it kind of made total sense at the time for film producers to start the organization or to run it and put it and create it.
So there was never a question whether it would be, whether they would use video or audio. It was.
I don't think that was a question at all at the beginning. I think it was right from the beginning clear that it was going to be filmed. Mm-hmm. I never heard about a discussion that happened. Should it be audio only? Should it be video? Should it be written? Anything? From what I know and how I always heard it, it seemed that it was always naturally that it was going to be film. It had to be film. Mm-hmm. That was clear, mm-hmm. because of who he is and what this is about. And I think for him, it was clearly the visual is very important, mm-hmm. because you use the visual to tell your story. So the foundation, as I said, was created in 94 already. They started to interview, and I know that the methodology of how to interview and how to videotape, etc., was developed in those early months. And I know that there was a lot of interaction with other organizations who've been doing this work already for many, many years. It was clear that the Shoah Foundation was not the first one to start saying, okay, we are now the only ones and the first ones to interview survivors. No, there was many, many organizations who've been doing this since 1945 in many different ways. I think the difference to what the Shoah Foundation was attempting to do was the immensity and the large-scale effort that was put in, that was basically starting to roll. And I think early on, too, sort of the goal was, in a sense, to give as many survivors the opportunity to tell their story, but also, a goal was set with a number, and that 50,000 would probably be the number to strive for. And so I think there are some discussions about how the number came up, and I think some of the calculations that were done is how many survivors are alive, how many percentage of those that may be still alive will want to give testimony, and then by the time we get to them, how many will then still be willing and can give testimony. So once you start going through all of this, the number of 50,000 kind of came out of it. And I think that then sort of seemed like, you know, that's the goal. A large-scale process was put in place to start doing this. And it wasn't that the Shoah Foundation went to every country in the world right away to start interviewing. They started locally in Los Angeles to do some interviews first to really shape the methodology. And it was very important that it was videotaped, that the quality of the video is what is for TV production considered broadcast quality at the time in the early 90s, and that the same video stock and quality guidelines are set for every interview, that it's consistent. And so the decision was made to do to use Betacam SP, the standard, that meant a certain kind of camera. The tape stock, I think, we bought and we then actually shipped to all the videographers. And the decision also that it would be, you know, in a person's home, that the interview will happen in the person's home, because it was considered sort of a safe place. We think that survivors would feel most comfortable doing it in their house. And if survivors who came forward, who wanted to give their story, did not want to do it in their house, we found other places for them to actually give interviews. And so some interviews, when I interviewed, for instance, my professor Scheffler as a war crimes trial participant, because he was an expert witness as a historian in many Nazi war crimes, including Demjanjuk at some point, who is now here in Munich and being tried. And when Demjanjuk was tried the first time, I think in the U.S., for having been Ivan the Terrible or something like that, I think at the time he observed the trial, and he at the time also thought that the documentation that was used to say that he was Ivan the Terrible was fake. He said that was wrong. He was not Ivan the Terrible. He was a Ukrainian Hofsguard, an auxiliary, but he wasn't the person that everybody thought he was. And then, you know, he was extradited to Israel, and in Israel, the first court thought he was guilty, and then the Supreme Court spoke him free, which was great, which was a big thing, too, that an Israeli court could did acquit mm-hmm. a perpetrator, mm-hmm. That they went that far, that they were that open to it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so then he went back to the United States, and now he's in Munich and actually being tried for what he really did, mm-hmm. or who he really was. So the methodology was in the people's homes, filmed certain quality, and that the interviews, you know, were supposed to be also in a very, it was supposed to be the life story. That was very important. It's not only about the history of the Holocaust. Now, the reason that the organization was founded and that people were mainly interviewed about and why had to do with the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, the experience of the Holocaust was a crucial element, but that the story and then the history that the person would tell was to be a life story. So that it was very important to sort of show that there's a life before and there was a life after. And so the interview methodology really was about telling the whole story from you know your first memory, so to speak, to the point of the interview. Now, having said that, the emphasis so in order to really do and strive for giving as many people the opportunity to tell their story and reach a goal of 50,000 and go into as many countries as you can and go into the countries where the survivors are. You had to also be practical to an extent, of course. And so, you know, one of the things, interviews couldn't be as long as they wanted to be. Also, it didn't seem humane to, you know, say, okay, you can speak as long as you want about all of everything and then go on. And I think that's probably also very hard for a person to go through. But if you also say, you know what, we're going to try and see if we tell the story in about 2 hours or so, let's see. So I don't know if it's everybody's approached it like this, but I think there was some understanding that an interview should be about 2 hours or so on average. Mm-hmm. Now, there are interviews, as I said, our archive ended up being between half an hour, the range is between half an hour and 17 hours. Mm-hmm. The longest interview is 17 hours, and I think the shortest interview is probably 10, 15, 20 minutes in mm-hmm. that respect. So you have really run the gamut. But if you now look at it, it's 105,000 hours in total of the 51,682 testimonies. They are on average 2 hours almost, 2 hours and 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it was, as I said, it was important to do the life story, but given that you had this time range, it was also clear as a methodology that the focus should be the wartime experience, and that the pre- and post-war should not be equal to the wartime experience in that sense. And so there were some general guidelines given, sort of spend 60% on the wartime and 20 on pre and 20 on post. But once you actually do it, and each individual story is so different. And, you know, and if you talk to somebody who left Germany in 1939 and was born in 1930, that pre-war story will be different than somebody who was born in 1915 and stayed in Poland the whole time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you really had to adjust. And so this 20-60-20 really is a very broad guideline that was given.
In terms of the film, mm-hmm. how was the decision made? It seems like that you have a certain format. You always only show the interviewee, not the interviewer. How was that decision?
Yeah. So I am not 100% sure I can give you an exact explanation about. And it's a very good question. I always wanted to sort of see. And I think in the beginning it was that the film producers got together also, and they're documentary filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And And I think it was important. This is really about the survivors, and it's about the survivor story. This was not about the interviewer and showing the interviewer. So that the survivors are the central, focal, and only point of the visual. Mm-hmm. That was important. Because then it's the emphasis here, that this interview is about them, it's them, and it's them telling their story in their own words. Mm-hmm. And that the role of the interviewer really was to be guiding and to ask follow-up questions and clarifying questions when appropriate. And the way the methodology was, what we ended up doing is, in a sense, that the interviewer introduces him or herself on camera. So there was a structure, you know, that at first it starts with a paper slate, that either a camera assistant or like the interviewer holds up a paper slate that has certain information about this interview that's about to be conducted. Then the camera shuts down. Then the interviewer walks around and sits next to the interviewee, and the camera is being put on again. And then the interviewer introduces himself on camera, says his name, spells his name, and says where they are, the date, and who this person is that's sitting next to them, and what they're going to do with this person. Meaning, you know, my name is Karen Junglet, I'm spelling it, I'm here today in Berlin, Germany, I'm interviewing, War Crimes Trial participant Wolfgang Schaeffler for the Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation. Mm-hmm. And today is May 14th, 2006. And then the cameraman shuts it off again. And then the interviewer walks around and sits right next to the camera, so that when they're asking questions and the interviewee looks, because the interviewee will look at the person that's doing the interview, right? And so this way it looks like you're looking right in the camera. And so I think all of that sort of was important in that respect. So that everything about this speaks that, A, you're not making the interviewer a fully anonymous. You are providing this person as a source first in the introduction. But then that the focus of everything is the interviewee. And then it was also, I know that there's a shot that's like a certain square around you. And, you know, when you look at our interviews, sometimes you see a lot more in the back. Meaning cameramen kind of were doing it, you know, a little differently sometimes. I mean, everybody interpreted guidelines in a different way too. I mean, guidelines are guidelines. You know, they're not the absolute rule, and the rule police is not there to say, no, you can't do this, you know. And so, and once it's done, you can't change it, right? So you see variation across all the interviews, but there are also certain consistencies, which is good. So on the one hand, it's felt that the guidelines were flexible enough for people to adjust depending on what situations they were in and what they had to work with, because people went into people's homes. And so cameramen, you know, they went with the interviewer, they met up and they went into the person's home, and then first they looked, what's a good place to do this? You know, what's a good background? What would look good? Maybe the survivor said, you know, this is where I want to be interviewed, or they said, you know, I don't care, you can do it wherever you want, kind of thing. And, but it should also be not intrusive. You know, if you had to move furniture, there was guidelines, make sure you put the furniture back. Also make sure you ask first for permission and that it's really okay, and those kinds of things. You know, you go into somebody's private home and it could be very intimidating when the cameraman and the interviewer comes and with the camera and all this, you know, the stuff and the stativ and the tripod and all those kinds of things. So that was sort of that methodology and part of the thinking, I think, behind it.
Just in terms of were the cameramen all professionals, or were they trained volunteers?
So all the videographers were professional videographers, and they were hired all locally. So all the interviews, they were done locally, they were coordinated locally, which means we hired regional coordinators all over the world in all the various cities that we then ended up doing interviews in. And these regional coordinators were responsible to find videographers locally, professional videographers. Usually they contacted, you know, either film producing or, companies that hired out videographers or independent videographers. So yes, they were all professionals and they were paid. Oftentimes we were able to have many, if not all, gave a reduced rate because they wanted to be part of this. So what the Shoah Foundation, and because of Steven Spielberg and Schindler's List, the only way, what actually was done, that there was such a incredible support worldwide from people to wanting to be part of this and wanting to help and support it in any which way they could. It was like a global movement, actually, in those days. Mm. Whatever city, and today even, when you go into cities, and so many times you meet somebody and they say, oh, you know, my friend was an interviewer. Oh, my aunt was interviewed. Or, you know, oh, I knew a videographer who did some interviews with you guys and stuff like that. There's always somebody that you run into that is where you never would think it, that knew somebody or was related to himself or did it or worked for the foundation in some capacity at some point. It's a little freaky. It's amazing. It's truly amazing, and it was really a project that inspired people, that engaged people, and so videographers, as I said, were professionals. Interviewers were also all local, and as I described, you know, I came to the foundation because of an interview training seminar. Basically, once the Shaw Foundation was going into a country in that sense, you know, you first announce and you sort of raise awareness about the project, and then you say, this is, you know, we're looking for people that are interested in doing this. Interviews were volunteers. So they were not paid people in that respect. They offered a stipend, I think, of $50 or so, depending on, but you could, you know, many people also said, you know what, the money goes back into the Shore Foundation to continue and make more interviews, so to speak. Because part of the funding, even though Steven Spielberg founded it, and he's the founding chairman and all that, and, you know, that kind of stuff, and he gave a lot of seed money. But it was, A, this was not going to be his project that he finances fully, and it was not meant to be. It was a project that is supposed to be financed by many people. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's for many people, it's for mankind, it should be supported by mankind, so to speak. Yeah. And that's really the philosophy, in a sense, too. And so he was always helpful, and he still is helpful with fundraising when it comes to it, but in the same sense, he's a burden and he's a blessing. Mm-hmm. So it was a blessing in the sense of his success, and Schindler's List opened the doors for survivors to say, you know what, yeah, I want to give my testimony to Steven Spielberg. Many survivors, they say on the testimony, actually, that they're giving their testimony to Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. They feel like they're giving to him personally. There was this personal connection that they felt. And because of who he is and what he did with Schindler's List and the effect it had, people felt like they were ready to open up. They trusted it. There was a trust that was there already that nobody had to create. Now, the people that worked for the Shore Foundation had to make sure they don't disappoint that trust by the way they do what they were doing, right? So that was very important. And so everybody was sort of, as I said, locally hired. Regional coordinators were staff in that respect, and then videographers were independent contractors, so to speak, and interviewers were volunteers and trained.
Just in terms of the video, mm-hmm. particularly interested in that, because mm-hmm. many oral historians don't use video, mm-hmm. And there are various reasons for that. But it seems that more and more oral historians are becoming interested in it, in part because the technology is becoming affordable.
Right.
You must have had discussions about video at the foundation. What do you see as sort of the major strength of video?
The major strength is, I was thinking about this before when I was talking about something that I was describing, my story, whatever, and I was, you know, I'm talking to you and I'm making a lot of hand things, you know, I'm using my hands to talk to you too, and I was doing things like pretending like I'm looking around the corner or something like that. All of that does not show up on your tape there, mm-hmm. but that's information. And that's part of how I'm telling the story. And you'll see it in the testimonies from our survivors. The nonverbal communication that happens is, there is so much information that you don't have if you don't videotape it, that gets lost on the audio. And in a sense, also, telling a story is a package deal. And when I say package deal, it's visual and audio. It's the words I'm using, it's the sound, It's my, the voice goes up and down. And, you know, am I getting nervous or not? That kind of the tenor of the voice, I guess. But also how I look and the faces I make. Mm-hmm. And the way I use my hands or something to describe something. That's information, and that's the way I'm telling the story. And that's all part of what you hear when you hear the words. Mm-hmm. So the words are just one part of the story. And that everything else, the way you use the words and how they come out of my mouth and what I look like when I say them, is information that belongs together with the words and should be looked at together. And so I think, as I said, Steven Spielberg, he's a filmmaker, visual is important. And for him, it's almost, I would think, and I never talked to him about this, I don't know, maybe you're just saying, but I think it's just instinctively that it had to be a visual because of all that information that exists. And to create also a visual memory and a legacy of the person that gave the testimony. So that later on you can, and I think you respond to somebody watching them telling the story totally differently than when you were reading a transcript or maybe just listening to it. And I'm sure even with oral historians, when you just did audio, when you listened to the testimony or you read the transcript, you guys probably were looking at this and listening to it and going, it's interesting. There's some difference. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I wouldn't have thought, if I just read it, I probably would have thought about what I was reading differently if I just read it. And now that I listened to it, interesting how that voice changes, and you're thinking about that. Maybe this is a little thought of. You think of it differently of that information.
Was there ever any sense that the interviews would actually be used in documentaries?
Well, the sense was that the interviews, it was to give the survivors a legacy, in a sense, and the opportunity to tell their story, and they were also to receive a copy. Everybody received a copy of their testimony. That was very important, so that they can also share it within their own family or, you know, give it on to their generations. And yes, that it was meant for educational use. And the reason why survivors give testimony, and almost everybody says it on their tape as well, is because they don't want people to forget. This is a legacy. They speak on behalf of all their family members that were killed, because, you know, more people were killed than survived. And so they're telling their story on behalf of those that cannot tell the story. And you hear that many, many, many times. And they wanted to tell it, and they wanted to give it so that it can be used for future generations and to educate and to basically be the warning, and so that it doesn't happen again. I mean, in that very simple kind of way. Simple, but yet very complicated, as we know. So, and that's really sort of how the Shoah Foundation then also evolved, in the sense of, establishing this methodology and collecting these testimonies all over the world, and then this diversity of interviews we had to come up with we didn't define who is a survivor, but we said we had a description of the kinds of experiences that we wanted to include in the archive, because that was very important. Many people were survivors during World War II or the Holocaust, or etc. But we were interested in experiences that sort of fit between, you know, if you were persecuted between 33 and 45 and for religious or racial reasons and political and other reasons. So we also interviewed political prisoners, we interviewed Jehovah's Witnesses, liberators, rescuers, survivors of eugenics policies, Jehovah's Witnesses, homosexual survivors. Mm. But the main, most of testimonies, you know, 95 or 96% are with Jewish survivors, for sure.
Okay, maybe you can just briefly describe your own work at the foundation. Mm-hmm. You're currently research director.
Yeah, so I'm currently director of research and documentation, and before that I was in charge of the whole cataloging and indexing effort of the testimonies, which we finished at the end of 2005. And in 2006, the Survivors of Shoah Visual History Foundation, or at the end of 2005, ceased to exist. It was basically closed down as it was known at that time, and the archive itself, the video testimonies, the broadcast quality, and all the different copies that we created digitally moved to USC, and the copyright is now University of Southern California. And the University of Southern California also established the USC Shoah Foundation Institute for Visual History and Education to continue the programmatic work that the survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation had already started doing, which means some of the staff that was part of the survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation moved to USC and was part of the USC Shoah Foundation Institute. And so the work that we now do at the University of California, A, we're part now of a large research university in the United States. Our archive is digitally accessible. We've made our analog copies are all being digitized again. We did one digital preservation copies years ago, which was DigiBeta, and we now just had to start another whole preservation effort last year. And we are the analog copies, which we have 235,000 half-hour beta SP tapes, are being redigitized into Motion JPEG 2000 format, which is also a format that the Library of Congress now uses for digital preservation. And partially we're doing that too because we knew that our tapes, we started to interview 94, and our CTO, Sam Gustman, always says, tape rots. And so at some point, you need to do something about it. You need to transfer it into another medium. And after a lot of research, et cetera, the decision was made, that's the new medium, or that's the preservation medium. And it's, and we were actually doing two digital copies, Motion JPEG 2000. And I think in total, it'll be like 4 petabytes. Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we're also doing compressed. We already have an MPEG-1 copy of it, which is a compressed video, which is what you access through our Visual History Archive interface, which is accessible at universities worldwide. And we're also making 3 smaller versions, which is QuickTime, Flash, and Window Media Player in, I think, 1 megabit per second. Per second or per minute? Wow, I should know that. Compressed version so that it's, if we were to use clips on the internet or testimonies on the internet. Since the regular internet, the MPEG-1 version, which is 3 megabits per second, that they're too large still for the internet. Mm. Actually, I tried to access it here from the hotel before and with my VPN, and the video was kind of playing, but the audio was totally out of sync and it was chopping up and you couldn't listen to it. So I can do it from my home in Los Angeles. I can actually go into it using the VPN. That's just because I guess my cable connection is very good or something. Mm-hmm. But it's very uncommon.
Yeah.
So anyway, so part of one of the things that I'd say, if you start with video, and now that you can also start doing digital video right away, you don't have to go from analog to digital, which is great. If you were still with analog, I would say, you know, be aware it's a lot of resources, financial resources you need to put in place in order to preserve it correctly. If you do digital right away, I think it's already much, much cheaper and much easier. And then when it comes to access, you can do a lot more things that you couldn't do before. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. I mean, you're talking about putting this, I know it's just audio, and you know, let's consider it's very small. If we were to do this on video, it'd be a little more problematic probably, even though not necessarily either, but you can put it on the web just like that. It's not a big deal anymore.
It sounds like that video still would be considerably more expensive as a technology.
I think for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you know it's one more step. Sure, you have your equipment is different. You know, even so, you have very digital, cheap digital cameras now. You can do it much, much easier now than you used to.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, if you do the difference between audio and video, of course, there will always be different. I don't think that will ever change. Also, you should never say never, but I can imagine.
But did you find any other sort of weaknesses, I guess, with video apart from costs? With that format, terms of interviews, maybe how interviewees reacted to it.
Yeah, I mean, sure. You know, what I said before, you come in with all this equipment into the room or into somebody's house, and, you know, most survivors just don't have the experience with being interviewed on camera, to be, you know, let alone interviewed and then on camera. And it can be very intimidating. There's no question about this. And they're already nervous, of course, because of what they're about to do. And, you know, even so, our methodology, you have a pre-interview that you do a week before, so that the interviewer and interviewee meet each other, so that they build a trust a little and get to know each other before the actual sitting down, and all those kinds of things. But still, it's a big event. It's a big event for most of them in their lives. There are some who, you know, who are used to talking because they've been going to schools, etc., and so they're, you know, maybe less used. But most of the survivors we've interviewed are, you know, never told their story in the first place to anybody. And so I think, without having been at 52,000 interviews, I am sure that most were nervous, anxious, not only because they were about to tell their story, but because of all that stuff around it, and the involvement and the setting up and their furniture is being changed and you know, and they need to be sitting down and they had to dress, you know, they were given, you know, many dressed up because they knew they wanted to look good, and, you know, and for women, is my makeup right, and what's my blouse, is it sitting, you know, all those kinds of things. It's all part of that, which can feel like can be overwhelming. But I also know that when you watch this testimonies, where in the beginning you see, you can feel the nervousness, and I've done a few interviews myself, so I've sort of had that experience in that respect, even myself as an interviewer, nervousness kind of thing, that it goes away. That once you start, and I had the same thing here. I was nervous before. I mean, listen, you know, I don't get interviewed every second, so it's just like, you know, it's a little thing you're putting in here, and you have a little tape recorder here, or a digital recorder, but it was a little weird at first. I'm going like, wow, I'm going to actually have to, can listen to this thing? Somebody can actually hear me say all these things? Oh my God, what's that going to mean? Or how am I going to sound? You know, I'm not having to worry about how I look, which is good. But it's all part of it. But then you forget about it. Mm-hmm. Once you start talking, in a sense, and you see it in the interviews, mm-hmm. you see that people don't, it goes away. Mm-hmm. It really goes away. And you can watch it go away.
Just one more sort of basic technical mm-hmm. question from mm-hmm. the interviews that I've seen. It looked as if cameramen would usually use natural lighting and not set up the light for kids. Was that part of the guidelines, or is that just...
You know what? I would have to say I don't know the exact answer. My experience was that there was always lighting. That it was always, and I've done now a couple of interviews just recently, again, with Cambodian genocide survivors, and we set up lighting. We set up lighting. It's supposed to be well lit. I mean, absolutely. But sometimes, you know, the circumstances, again, where are you doing the interview in somebody's home? How many outlets are conveniently available? If they're not, if the cameraman did bring lights, does he have batteries for the lights? Didn't, then maybe you need to readjust of where you're going to do the interview. We've done three interviews in Rwanda last year, and we couldn't do it in somebody's house because they didn't have electricity. So we did it in their garden. Well, that was natural light as you can think of natural light, and there was a thunderstorm coming, and I was hoping that it's not going to rain on us, and the light was changing, and you could see now when I watched the interview, you could see how it gets darker and darker and darker. Not because the sun goes down, because the clouds are getting more and more. Mm-hmm. But in general, it was, no, with lighting and everything. Mm-hmm. It was all part of it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you just talked about Cambodia.
Yeah, where jumping around.
What's that?
I said I'm jumping around.
No, but I'm not quite sure about the time. Like, I think we have to go ahead.
What time do we have?
12:30.
So you're probably in the next 10 minutes.
So maybe you can just sort of finish by telling us where the foundation is going, and if you want to sort of you see your own future goals.
Well, the foundation, where the foundation is going, is you know, we completed almost the index in the archiving that respect of the 52,000 testimonies. Not complete. There are still some testimonies to be indexed, but that effort is more or less accomplished in that respect. And now really the focus is on using these testimonies in an educational setting and making them digitally accessible to students, secondary and higher education. Scholars, researchers use them in the classroom, and whether that is, you know, secondary education classroom or college, university level seminars, classrooms, what have you. And that's really, that's a main focus of the Institute's work, in addition to, of course, continuing to preserve the testimonies, which is a huge undertaking. And then the other side of things is to also start looking into expanding the archive now with testimonies of survivors of other genocides. And so one of the relationships that was built a couple of years ago already was an organization in Rwanda called Ibuka. And Ibuka is an umbrella survivor organization in Rwanda, meaning they oversee and or coordinate with many other survivor organizations. There's a lot of sort of survivor organizations, which also happen, you know, among the Jewish survivors too, that like sort of orphans created their own survivor organizations. You have women who created their organization, and et cetera, et cetera. And Ibuka is sort of this umbrella organization, and they approached us and started to talk to us and interested in creating a project and an archive of videotaped testimonies in Rwanda that is sort of modeled, I mean, I guess sort of modeled and or inspired by the Shoah Foundation in that respect. And so they asked us to collaborate with them and assist them in advising and in many other ways. And so we are partnering with them in that respect. And for us, it's to help them to do what they want to do. And what we, you know, also like to do then is get copies of these testimonies and integrate them into the archive and make them accessible with the already established Holocaust Survivor and Witnesses Archive together. And also look at other experiences. And Cambodia was, as we just mentioned before, and Ibuka, and that project is really one with more on a larger scale, really, because Ibuka is attempting to do many, many testimonies. One of their goals is, in a sense, to do about 15,000. And that's not an endeavor that we can sort of do with many others equally at the same time. And so really Ibuka in that respect is right now sort of this one partnership where a large number of testimonies is envisioned from the partner, and it'll take some time to undertake this, also fundraising and given the economy and et cetera. We're not even going to talk about that. The other partnership that sort of I worked on and established was with Documentation Center in Phnom Penh. Who are also, it's a research center, and they've been doing interviews themselves already for quite some time. They were actually established, they came out of a project that was done by Yale, and it was first in field office and then became an independent organization, I think 97. And their focus really is also to become a central point for anything and everything that has to do with the Khmer Rouge regime. From testimony, they were also, most of what they actually, their work was to support the collection of all documentation that is now being used in the trials of former Khmer Rouge perpetrators, which is happening right now in Cambodia. So we started to talk, and one of the things that we said we could do together is we can send three staff members to the Institute, and what these staff members did, they learned, interned with us for 3 months, and I took them through basically from what we've done from A to C. So we spent some time on interviewing methodology, we spent some time on going through the pre-interview questionnaire that we created, and then I had them create a pre-interview questionnaire for the Cambodian experience. Then they learned indexing and cataloging, they learned some of our preservation efforts. They were then in the ITS department, Information Technology Services, actually helped with the preservation of the current archive. And then we also conducted 2 interviews with local survivors, Cambodian survivors in Long Beach. And I had each of them conduct one of the interviews. And we hired a local videographer that we used. And we happened to do the interviews in our Institute's offices because for both individuals, they didn't want to do it in their home. And that was a very, very interesting experience. And And the pre-interview questionnaire, now we have a pre-interview questionnaire draft that is for Cambodian genocide survivors. And it was very interesting for them because the interviews that they were doing so far was really, they were just going out in the field, interviewing people that were, you know, on the rice field, et cetera, walking up to them saying, are you interested in being interviewed? And many of them said yes. And then they just interviewed them really about the Khmer Rouge experience as much as they just sort of had time and do. And when they were with us and we were talking about this, they, you know, at the end they said they really now understand the importance of really doing a life story and that they really want to go back and sort of incorporate that into their way of doing interviews from now on, among other things, and trying to see if they can actually also do a pre-interview questionnaire. Even so, the one we developed is almost also many pages long, and it may practically not be feasible for them to do it the way they do interviews. But whatever it is, the idea was to be trained and to be thinking about this in a more organized and looking at standards and consistent way of doing interviews. And so that's what they're taking back to Cambodia and trying to incorporate as much as they can into their way of doing things. And so, and it was very gratifying to see and to work with them. And then the two testimonies, we have dual ownership, basically, or copyright, so they will get a copy of the testimony and we have a copy of the testimonies. And we hope that that kind of collaboration and partnership, that we either we can continue to do more interviews in some fashion, and if we were to reach out to any other or for any other experience, it would always be in partnership with somebody else. It would, what we know is Holocaust survivors and witnesses. That's where we were at. But so anything else we would do would always be with partners who have some experience, knowledge, expertise in that other area in some fashion. Hence, you have that partnership with Ibuka and Documentation Center.
Great.
So, and where I'd like to see this going, I'd like to see this become really part of the work in the next few years of expanding the archive, because I think when you talk to survivors from the different, having talked to Holocaust survivors, Rwandan genocide survivors, and Cambodian genocide survivors, they all appreciate the effort of people documenting and hearing from them who went through it to hear what it was like, etc. And sort of you sort of see that you see a commonality about, I guess, how they think about this now and those kinds of things, and you sort of see the importance of without being afraid that you're relativizing one or the other, without fearing that you're comparing them in a sense of, well, who had it worse kind of stuff. That is all nonsense to me. It's about really documenting each one and for people to have the opportunity to hear from them about all the different ways, and to see and to be able to just look at it and go, you know, there are commonalities and there are, of course, many, many, many differences. But the commonality of people being, you know, killed and murdered for just who they are, you see very quickly. And I think survivors appreciate the efforts and would support it. I think I'm done, am I?
Great. Well, thank you very much for the interview.
You're welcome, Alex.